Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present independent journalist and author Darja Mail, who examines the provisions of the U.S.-Iraqi Status of Forces Agreement to withdraw American troops by 2011, recently approved by the Iraqi Parliament. Kim Bobo, founder and executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice, who discusses the exploitation of millions of workers described in her new book, Wage Theft in America. And Anne Standback of the Connecticut group Love Makes a Family, who talks about the successful campaign which led to the state Supreme Court decision legalizing gay marriage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the global financial crisis spread, the United States and European governments acted quickly to allocate $4.4 trillion in bailouts for failing banks like Citigroup and Bear Stearns. At the same time, Western governments held back on commitments to two other global crises: the fight against extreme poverty and battling climate change. According to a new report by the Institute for Policy Studies, the $4 trillion effort to unfreeze credit markets is 45 times the level of development aid spent by the U.S. and EU governments. It is also more than 300 times the level of commitments to counter global climate change. By itself, the $150 billion takeover of insurance giant AIG far exceeded the entire development aid budget for the U.S. and European governments combined. Meanwhile, the global recession is expected to hit the developing world especially hard. The United Nations International Labor Organization projects that 20 million people globally will lose their jobs during the recession, and an additional 40 million people will earn less than a dollar a day. This is on top of the 100 million people who were thrown into poverty by the recent spike in world food prices. A study by Harvard Public Health researchers estimates 330,000 people have died of AIDS in South Africa due to the denial of treatment policies of the government of former President Thabo Mbeki. The study, published in the Scientific Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndromes, plots the AIDS death rates from 2000 to 2005, when Mbeki was an AIDS skeptic and opposed use of antiretroviral drugs for AIDS treatment. The South African government at the time claimed the drug AZT was toxic and attempted to block a $72 million program organized by the Global Fund for AIDS in the hard-hit province of KwaZulu-Natal. During the same period, neighboring countries Botswana and Namibia launched major AIDS treatment programs, including a program to block mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS. In Botswana, treatment covered 85% of AIDS patients. According to the World Health Organization, nearly 19% of South Africa's population has AIDS. In 2005, 900 people a day were dying from AIDS in the country. Mbeki, who recently resigned from office, relied on a strategy that emphasized traditional African remedies, including herbs. South Africa's new health minister, Barbara Hogan, has promised to increase funding for the treatment of AIDS and has won praise from AIDS activists. A gay man was arrested in Iraq for talking with another gay man via telephone. He was later found dead, blindfolded, and shot twice. According to the Progressive magazine, homosexuals in Iraq are actively targeted by Shia militias and the government, and are often victims of murder and torture in a campaign gay activists call sexual cleansing. Iraqi LGBT, which refers to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, says over 450 gays have been killed in Iraq since 2003. Gay men and transgender people are the most vulnerable. In 2005, Shiite cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani issued a fatwa calling for the death of gays and lesbians in the severest way possible. Iraqi LGBT, with the help of Western groups, set up a series of safe houses for gays, but funding was limited and people protecting the houses were killed. Homosexuality was legal under Saddam Hussein until 2001, when under pressure from religious conservatives, sodomy was criminalized. Now gays are completely marginalized. Exile Ali Hilli declared, "The problem is that no one is sympathizing with us. No one is standing up for us, not even the Communist Party or any of the religious parties." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
As a spike of bombings and shootings claimed dozens of lives across Iraq, the nation's parliament narrowly approved a security pact with the U.S. on November 27th, which requires a withdrawal of all American combat troops by December 31st, 2011. The three-year agreement, backed by Bush administration ally Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, schedules U.S. combat forces to leave Iraqi cities and towns by June 30, 2009. What's known as the Status of Forces Agreement also requires joint U.S.-Iraqi decisions on authorizing American military missions, arrests, searches of homes and property, and opens the door for Iraqi courts to deal with some specific criminal cases involving American soldiers. A national referendum on the withdrawal agreement is scheduled to be held on July 31, 2009. But because there is widespread opposition to the pact by Iraqis who want a more rapid U.S. withdrawal, many observers predict it could be rejected by voters, forcing a renegotiation of the timeline. The results of provincial council elections on January 31st could signal which way the political winds are blowing for the unpopular al-Maliki government. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with independent journalist and author Dar Jamail, who reported from Iraq for 8 months between November 2003 and February 2005. Jamail examines the provisions of the U.S.-Iraqi Status of Forces Agreement and the volatile situation in Iraq that President-elect Barack Obama will inherit when he takes office in January.
Now, let's be real clear. This is an Iraqi government in Baghdad that does not exist without the U.S. occupation. It enjoys less than 1% support from the entire Iraqi population, and they have just basically voted to give the U.S. Basically 3 years now to continue on in the occupation, but the devil is in the details, and we have to be very, very clear about the wording that's being used for this. For example, they're saying, okay, all combat troops will be withdrawn by 2011, by the end of 2011. Well, combat troops, less than one-third of the 154,000 U.S. military personnel in Iraq today are technically combat troops. So we're looking at, even within an incoming Obama administration, his security advisors, and now we just see he's keeping Robert Gates on as defense secretary, he's appointed Hillary Clinton as secretary of state, I mean, one of the hawkish Democrats that we have, and it's no big surprise because his advisors, even before he got the Democratic nod to run as the Democratic Party presidential candidate, his advisors were calling on keeping between 60 and 90,000 U.S. military personnel in Iraq until the end of his first term, which is 2013. So that is exactly what we see playing out on the ground right now, where I'm sure they would love to take some of the combat troops from Iraq and pop them over in Afghanistan, which is exactly what Robert Gates wants to do, exactly what Barack Obama has said he wants to do by February, is take 20,000 troops from Iraq and put them into Afghanistan. And another important thing that this segues into that neither Barack Obama nor the Bush administration will address is the use of private contractors. Because for the first time in the history of the U.S. military, they're involved in a conflict where there's actually more private contractors on the ground in Iraq today than there are U.S. military personnel. There are today over 185,000 private contractors in Iraq and about 154,000 U.S. military personnel. So even Barack Obama himself has said, you know, if we're going to be pulling troops out of Iraq, we can't talk about pulling contractors out. So it's sent a very clear message that basically that is likely to be the scenario where if and when we do pull out 20, 30,000 troops, even as many as 50,000 from Iraq, I think it's safe to say we should expect a pretty large uptick of replacements in the private contractor sector.
Dar, there is some recognition in Iraq that this Iraqi government, the ally of the Bush administration, is not representative of the Iraqi population, so that this Status of Forces agreement is supposed to be put before the public in a referendum, and I believe it's the end of July of 2009. Is this thing likely to be passed or fail if it's subjected to a vote?
See, that's another caveat that's very interesting, where this is such a complex situation. On one hand, the Bush administration has been under great time pressure to try to lock in, to legalize the occupation as much as possible before an incoming administration comes in, the Barack Obama administration, so that if this administration was intent on making radical changes in the foreign policy in Iraq, it would make it much more difficult for them to do so, because now a lot of this has been voted into law by the Iraqi government. But if this does go up for a referendum in front of the Iraqi people later on, about halfway through next year, as it is scheduled to do, I think it would be unequivocally denounced. I think that it would be a landslide of opposition against this, and I think that's another reason why the Iraqi government was happy to go ahead and do this now, kind of let the Bush administration, you know, do this now, because we're basically going to pull the rug out from under it in about 6-9 months. And an interesting thing is, when this status of forces agreement, when the announcement was made in Baghdad that this passed, there were celebrations in Tehran. Because the reality is, Iran now has gained the upper hand politically, because they know that the vast majority of the people in Iraq, over 71% according to recent polls, want the occupation over in less than a year's time, no matter what, so that when this does come up for a referendum vote, it will be absolutely denounced. And I'm not a lawyer. I would need to talk to someone a bit more studied in international law to understand what that will actually mean then. If 6-9 months down the road we have a referendum vote, then will that nullify everything that's happening right now?
What is the future of the al-Maliki government, do you think, as the United States, either by the facts on the ground or through referendums, loses some of their control over what's going on there in Iraq?
Well, again, it's very, very precarious, and we'll have to see what plays out on the ground and if there are any big policy changes with the Barack Obama administration. Again, one thing we can say for sure is this is a Vichy government, basically. It doesn't exist without the occupation. If the U.S. decided to close up shop tomorrow and just move completely out of the country, every single one of these Iraqi politicians in the green zone, that is where the government, that the Iraqi government is located, it's in the green zone, which is a bit telling. They would have to go out inside those tanks and airplanes as well, because, as I said, there is no love lost for them from the Iraqi population. So they're completely dependent on the occupation. You know, as long as the occupation persists, I think we can expect them to maintain power. But if the U.S. ever does come to a point, either through economics, because our country goes completely bankrupt and can't maintain a foreign occupation, or for other unforeseen reasons, if they have to pull out, this government would, I think, immediately collapse.
That was independent journalist Dar Jamail. Read his articles online at dahr.org. Jamail is the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. While the nation is focused on the economic meltdown on Wall Street, a deepening recession, and the threat of rising unemployment on Main Street, another crisis has been hidden from view: the epidemic of corporations stealing wages from their workers. According to Kim Bobo, founder and executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice and author of the book Wage Theft in America: Why Millions of Working Americans Are Not Getting Paid and What We Can Do About It, billions of dollars are stolen from workers across the U.S. every year. While many Americans are aware that undocumented immigrants are frequently cheated out of wages due to their vulnerable legal status, most people would be surprised to learn that 2 or 3 million workers, legal citizens from all ethnic backgrounds, are not paid the minimum wage or are denied overtime pay. Industries that have a poor track record of paying their workers what they deserve include agriculture, poultry processing, janitorial services, restaurant work, garment manufacturing, workers in healthcare facilities, and retail stores. Labor unions are one of the most effective institutions protecting employees from wage theft, but less than 10% of U.S. workers are union members. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kim Bobo about the scope of the problem, the lack of fair wage enforcement at the federal and state levels, and what the incoming Obama administration can do to address the wage theft crisis.
The thing about wage theft is most of us think, well, it's just happening, you know, one little store or one little restaurant or one little problem here or there, and we don't think about it as a national crisis, and yet it's very clear right now that we have a national crisis, and that it is not just, you know, a few bad apples. It's really a bad orchard right now. So, you know, people always say to me, well, Kim, how do people steal wages? How does that happen, right? So one way, 2 to 3 million workers aren't paid the minimum wage, right? That's just a flat-out violation of the law. And, you know, they're paid you know, sometimes a little bit under, but sometimes a lot under. 3 million workers are misclassified as independent contractors when they're really employees. And that not only steals wages from workers, because usually they're not paid overtime when they're owed overtime if they're classified as an independent contractor, but it also steals money from public coffers, because the employers then don't pay workers' comp, they don't pay unemployment, they don't pay the payroll side of FICA taxes. So it really steals from the entire society. A very common way that workers have their wages stolen is by they're eligible to have overtime and they're not paid overtime. And that happens to literally millions of workers. Then we have illegal deductions that get taken. You know, employers fine workers and take money out of their paychecks that they can't do. Then we have some workers, particularly in residential construction, who just don't get paid at all, right? They get taken to a job, they work all day, and then they don't get paid. Not paying a last paycheck is a pretty common way to steal wages. So somebody works and then resigns, the employer doesn't pay them the last paycheck, or the worker gets fired, and again, the employer doesn't pay the last paycheck, even though it doesn't even matter if you're fired. You still have to get paid for the work that you've done up to that point. So these are all sort of pretty typical ways that employers steal wages. And again, it's not just a few places, right? It's 60% of nursing homes steal wages, 100% of poultry plants, 90% of farm labor, 50% of restaurants. I mean, it's just huge numbers, and it's both small, sometimes mom-and-pop shops that may not really understand the laws quite well, and then it's big companies like Walmart, right, that have, right now, there's 60 lawsuits out against Walmart, all alleging that the company has stolen wages.
You describe how federal and state enforcement is so lax that this kind of wage theft can go on unchecked, because there really is not the will to enforce the wage and hour laws, but also not even the personnel at the state or federal levels to actually do the job, even if they wanted to.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, there are 130 million workers in the country that are covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that's the law that is the minimum wage and the overtime law, right? So that on some level is, there's lots of laws, but that's the most fundamental worker protection law, right? 130 million workers covered. There are 750 enforcement staff for the entire country. Now, you know, you just can't do the job with that few enforcement staff. And so what the enforcement staff tell me that they do is they do triage. They do the absolute best they can with limited resources. But what we're seeing as a result is that employers know that they can steal wages with virtually no consequence from the federal government. Now, the only place that's sort of picking up the slack here is the private bar, right? The attorneys are filing increasing number of cases against employers. And so on some level, they're doing the job that the federal government ought to be doing in terms of employment. But it's not enough, right? Because the private bar, as good as many of these attorneys are, they tend to want to take the cases where there's large dollar amounts involved or lots of workers involved. And frankly, they're not all that interested in the case of, you know, the guy that lost his job and didn't get his $300 last paycheck, right? I mean, that's important to that guy, but it's not all that interesting to an attorney. That's what we need the federal government to be protecting workers against, that kind of wage theft.
What do you hope that the Barack Obama administration will be doing when they take office in January to actually address this issue of wage theft and really, you know, take a hard look at changing the way the federal government enforces the laws around wages and hours, trying to prevent what's going on in terms of the theft of billions of dollars and exploitation of workers?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm hopeful that we're going to see some really dramatic changes very quickly in terms of wage enforcement, because, you know, when I started writing the book, you know, things were so bad, I really thought the Department of Labor didn't have the authority it needed to do the job. But as I researched the book, I realized they have the authority, they're just not using it. So there's so many things that they could do almost immediately, and I'm quite encouraged, but, you know, I do think the leadership question is going to matter, and, you know, whoever the person is, if they don't have a lot of experience with wage enforcement issues, we're going to need them to get up to speed right away. And that's really, you know, that's going to be all of our job to make sure they understand what a priority this is.
That was Kim Bobo, founder and executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice and author of the book, Wage Theft in America, Why Millions of Working Americans Are Not Getting Paid and What We Can Do About It. Contact Interfaith Worker Justice by calling area code 773-728-8400 or visit their website at iwj.org. Gay marriage became legal in Connecticut on November 12th after a state Supreme Court ruling on October 10th that declared gay and lesbian couples have a constitutional right to equal protection in marriage. The ruling in the case, known as Kerrigan and Mock versus Connecticut Department of Health, was the result of a lawsuit filed by 8 gay and lesbian couples in 2004 after they were denied marriage licenses. The following year, the Connecticut legislature passed a civil unions law, providing gays and lesbians all the legal rights of marriage within the state, but did not address the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. DOMA, passed in 1996, denies gay couples federal recognition of state marriages, which provides for federal benefits in areas such as Social Security, taxation, and immigration. Connecticut is now the second state, after Massachusetts, where gay marriage is legal. The California State Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage in 2008, but was overturned by a binding voter referendum in the state on November 4th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ann Stanback, executive director of Love Makes a Family, the state organization that led the fight for gay marriage. She discusses her group's successful campaign and what they'll be working on in the future.
Connecticut was unique among a lot of states that we have had an active court strategy and an active legislative strategy for the last 4 years. And Love Makes a Family has been working closely with GLAAD, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, who brought the Kerrigan lawsuit to this Connecticut Supreme Court. And, you know, making sure that we were collaborating on our educational activities and just working hand in hand so that we knew what each other was doing. But Love Makes Family has been working in the legislature for the full 8 years. And I think that while our opponents are very critical of the fact that we won this in the court and that somehow that is not democratic, I think that if we had not gotten a ruling from the court, if we had gotten a bad ruling when the legislature convened in January, that we would have seen the legislature pass a marriage bill. After this election cycle, we have the votes, and I think they were ready to take it up. And the court just beat us to it. But, you know, we want equality sooner rather than later, so, you know, we certainly support that court decision.
Here in Connecticut, we don't have binding ballot questions, but there was an effort to call a constitutional convention, which I believe has to come up as a ballot question every 20 years, regardless of what else is going on in the state. How much of that push to have a constitutional convention was tied to opponents of gay marriage? Because there were other issues, too, that other groups were concerned about and didn't want to have a constitutional convention either.
The two organizations who were most aware of that 20-year mark and that it was going to come up in 2008 were Love Makes Family and the Family Institute of Connecticut, because we had figured out a few years back that there was a likelihood that the year that we got legalized marriage equality in Connecticut was going to be the same year that citizens were going to be voting on this constitutional convention ballot question. And we figured, and the Family Institute finally figured this out too, that really their only opportunity to stop this, because they weren't going to get a constitutional amendment that defined marriage between a man and a woman, a constitutional DOMA in the Connecticut Constitution via the legislature, that the only way they could do that was to do it through this statewide referendum. They began framing this ballot question about holding a constitutional convention as the first step in defining marriage in our Constitution as between a man and a woman. And once the decision came down from the Supreme Court, 3 weeks before the election, it was, really ratcheted up in terms of their discussions about this being a referendum on marriage. We were very open that that was, being that the campaign was being waged that way, and we said to voters that to vote yes was a vote to ban gay marriage and ban abortion, which was another issue that they were concerned with. And we won that question 60-40%. And I think that it says a lot about the state of Connecticut. I think it says a lot about the work that our activists have done over the last 8 years to, move public opinion and gain acceptance for marriage equality. But it also says, that the people of Connecticut are fair-minded and they're not willing to strip people of their rights.
You just said that it says a lot about the people in Connecticut and perhaps the legislators that, you don't expect a big blowback. But what do you expect when the legislature convenes in terms of any possible attack on gay marriage?
Well, we had two hurdles. One was the Constitutional Convention ballot question vote, and we won that handily. And then the next will be the efforts by the Family Institute and the Connecticut Catholic Conference to try to pass a constitutional amendment through the legislature. We don't take anything for granted, and we're going to work hard to defeat that. But I am very confident that we will be able to crush that effort if we continue the work that we've done over the past 8 years. I mean, it's just very clear that we have the votes to pass a marriage bill. We certainly have the votes to defeat a DOMA, a constitutional DOMA. So I think that looks very positive. And once we get past this legislative session, you never, as a political organizer, like to say never, but I feel like, we can really check this off, that the threat is gone and that marriage will continue to exist for same-sex couples in the state of Connecticut. We still are not equal in the eyes of our nation because of the federal DOMA that says that the federal government cannot recognize same-sex marriages in the states and provide those important federal benefits like Social Security and tax benefits, immigration status. And we will be beginning the work now to work to repeal the federal DOMA, working with our congressional delegation, working with GLAAD and others who will be fighting this on other fronts, and just doing the education to remind people that we took a huge step on November 12th, but we're not quite there yet.
That was Ann Standback, Executive Director of Love Makes a Family. Call them at area code 860-525-7777. Or visit their website at lmfct.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.